We are talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of the past year. Actually, last year, since today is the first day of the new year. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And
Joff is here.
Well, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Perhaps this one will have some surprises for us like the last one did.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, we started last week, as we do every year, started last week doing a summary of the most overrated, underrated, overhyped, underhyped, focusing on local stories last week, and this week focusing on national and international stories. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
And you have both been churning all week, going through all your old paperwork and, you know, putting different weights on different stories and using
reliving past traumas. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
2021 was like that.
And how best to tackle this for this week? Would one of you be so kind as to?
Did you want to start off, Joff?
Sure, I do most overhyped and underreported, and you know the overhyped was pretty easy last year. All the pandemic disinformation, which you know social media spread very effectively, and which killed a lot of people, like hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. alone. And certainly, you know, there's disinformation in the rest of the world as well. You know, this is really something that public health officials will have to study for how to do public messaging in the future. And I think the problem was unique in this country because somehow public health got politicized. And that was really, you know, not pointed out by most media, and the both-siderisms that media tend to engage in, you know, talking about whether that's a good political strategy or not, and not whether, for instance, it's true or not, I think was a huge problem in 2021. And we saw that with how the pandemic was handled. We saw it with how the attempted coup on last January 6th was handled. You know, we really have at least one political party that, you know, used to complain about postmodernism and how there's no real truth, and now engages in that kind of Orwellian tactic. It's very disconcerting and something that needs to be pointed out by media that, you know, tries to report on objective reality as often as possible, because, you know, media literacy, as we've talked about on this show many times, is not, not widespread in this country, and, it needs to be. So, yeah, that was on my list. And then, let's see, the overhyped, paralysis of Democrats in Congress and all the sausage making and all the drama of, is this going to get passed? Is that going to get passed? And of course, none of it got passed because, Republicans, are united in opposition to anything that Joe Biden proposes. And Democrats have a couple members in the Senate who do not want to abolish the filibuster. That basic calculus has never changed. And yet, you know, thousands of hours of airtime were devoted to, you know, are the Democrats going to do this? Oh, they can't do that. Oh, they're in disarray, et cetera, et cetera. And the bottom line is that it is the Republicans in the U.S. Senate that are blocking pretty much everything from passing. So, you know, it's, I don't understand why,
I don't understand the focus on you know, different elements within the Democratic Party in the House when everything stalled in the Senate. That would be my take on that. That it was the Republicans and a couple of very conservative Democrats in the Senate that really held up just about everything this year. And the focus in the press was always on the far left Democrats in the House and how they were being obstructionist, not how they were working as hard as they could to try to shape these bills to be as fair as they felt they could be and to help as many people as possible. And not very many things got held up in the House. The House actually passed a lot of stuff this year. It's just it never made a lot of it never made it through the Senate. So that would be kind of at the top of my list for overhyped this year.
Shall we move to the underreported and the top stories of 2021? Because God knows there were a lot of them.
Yeah, yes. Let's do it.
Okay.
So at the top of my list is the messy rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines. You know, at the start of the year, only about 3 million Americans, mostly healthcare workers and first responders, had been vaccinated. And with no single website, phone number, or place to go to register for the shot when the vaccines were available to everyone, it just took way too long for people to find a place and find an appointment to get vaccinated. And there still is no single place that tracks who and how many people have actually received shots, whether they're fully vaccinated or not, much less who has received a booster shot. You would think that that would be the top priority in a pandemic. But apparently that's not the case, and that was never really covered at all in the press. No one ever really said we need, at least at the state level, you need major coordination, but it would be best if at the national level we had one place for people to go to get an appointment and get the vaccine.
Well, this goes back to the original sin of the Trump administration with the pandemic, and that is, you know, delegating everything to the states so that instead of one system, you have 50 systems. Instead of one rollout, and, you know, until Biden came in, they discovered that there was actually no plan for a rollout at all. You know, instead of one rollout with one set of rules, you've got 50 rollouts with 50 sets of rules, and every state has to invent it from scratch and say, well, we're going to prioritize seniors, or we're going to prioritize the disabled.
Every state has to buy into the fact that the vaccine is important, and that didn't happen either.
That's true too.
Republican run states where there were just people in charge who were anti-science and vaccine deniers.
But even in our own state, you know, where Governor Inslee was fairly progressive on his approach, he still most of the time bowed to the interests of businesses and would tweak things to benefit them. Mm-hmm. You know, so
I think that happened more and more as time went on. You know, it was pretty solid in the beginning in terms of his trying to follow the science.
Yeah, but even, you know, even in ours, there's only so much you can do at the state level, too. Even in our state, where we had a Department of Health website, a state Department of Health website that was supposed to help you find the vaccine, you know, you could go to that Department of Health website and it still wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. You were looking among many different providers, some of them in the private sector, some of them, you know, sponsored with state money or city money. And a lot of places where you could get the vaccine were not listed on the state site, or the information was outdated, or it took you to a website that then took you to a different website that then you had to click. You know, it just was way too cumbersome. And it was not well coordinated, even in a state here where we have a large proportion of people who actually were able to eventually get the vaccine. It still was messy as heck and did not need to be that messy.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that was for people, you know, just between the three of us that are fairly internet savvy. And I saw from many people who weren't so savvy that they were just having nightmares.
And that led to volunteers, younger volunteers, stepping in and helping older people navigate getting their vaccine appointments, et cetera. It really shouldn't have been that hard.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of older people, who didn't grow up with the internet, basically, don't necessarily have access to it or have a hard time navigating it. I know my mother, who passed away a couple years ago, she never, ever, ever touched the internet because she's just afraid of it. And there really were not many accommodations met for those very medically vulnerable people being able to access the information. It's the assumption is that everybody's internet savvy in our happy, hippy-dippy little state.
But that's not true. No. Yeah. So, Jav, what was number one on your list?
The interesting thing to me was that in the first year of the pandemic, in 2020, we got a ton of stories of who we've lost, you know, and they weren't necessarily celebrities, just ordinary people. It was an attempt by by corporate media to try and humanize and try and put in context the death toll, which was so unprecedented. And then in 2021, those stories basically disappeared. Only time we heard about deaths were when it was a nice round number that we had passed, most recently 100,000, or when it was a celebrity that had died, or a sports star, or, you know, whomever.
Or in some cases, people who died because they couldn't get access to a bed to treat their heart condition or a stroke or something because the beds were all full of COVID-19 patients.
Yeah, but in those cases, generally, those kind of situations lasted a week, and we maybe heard about it in one news cycle when somebody died. We have lost so many people to this pandemic that it is hard to wrap your brain around. It's hard to realize that every one of those 815,000 or whatever it is now, people who died had families, had people who cared about them. In many cases, obviously, didn't want to die that early, died earlier than they should have. And we have lost, we've become numb to it, basically. And I think media has become numb to it as well, where, you see these charts in the newspaper every day and people might skim over them or they might not. But it's, the fact that for most of 2021, those deaths were largely preventable. And that's the other category of something that might show up in the news is if somebody who's been a prominent vaccine denier dies from the virus, which of course has been happening on a pretty regular basis.
I think on the other hand, that sets up this notion in people's minds that the folks who are dying are all vaccine deniers, which is not the case. Folks who are vaccine deniers certainly are getting sick and sicker than people who have been fully vaccinated. But there are plenty of people who have been fully vaccinated who have also, immunocompromised older people, even some very young people who have gotten sick and died from it too, who needlessly got the virus because, I think, of vaccine deniers. So it's important for people to know that as well.
Yeah. About 99% of the fatalities in 2021 were of people who were unvaccinated. It's a remarkably high percentage. And probably a good chunk of the rest of them were, people who were immunocompromised in one way or another. Cancer patients or transplant patients or whatever they were. The disinformation, I talked about this earlier, the disinformation of the pandemic has been incredibly deadly, and that needs to be called out more often than it is.
So number two on my list is a vaccine mandate should have been non-controversial, okay? And in fact, the vast majority of people who have refused the COVID-19 vaccine were vaccinated as children. against things like measles, tetanus, diphtheria, polio, and a whole host of other diseases that could have killed them, like COVID-19. But as adults, they felt free to deny science and then risk their lives and the total breakdown of the healthcare system. Instead, they've made excuses that were sometimes political, but mostly just head in the sand stupid for not getting vaccinated. Now, we can blame the Republicans, but everyone makes their own decision. And I think a lot of it's just plain stupidity and fear of needles or defiance of authority. You know, some people who just don't want to do what everyone else is doing. But I think it's clear now that the only thing that will make most of those holdouts get vaccinated is the threat of losing their jobs. So it really has to hit their pocketbooks. And yet, Republican governors have sued the Biden administration to stop a vaccine mandate for private employers. And in the meantime, you have Republican politicians, the same folks who are voting against vaccine mandates and who are pushing to do away with them, who are dropping dead from COVID-19, whether it's Colin Powell or here in Washington State, whether it's Doug Sutherland, who was the main anti-vaccine. Doug Erickson, who was the main anti-vaccine legislator in the Washington state legislature, dropping dead from COVID-19. So to me, it seems like the vaccine mandate is not controversial, and yet somehow it was made controversial. And the media did not really cover that very much. To say that, look, it's these people who are denying science and somehow for political reasons who are denying science, who are murderers, and they're killing themselves. And we really need to institute the vaccine mandate as soon as possible.
The part that left me gobsmacked was when the right wing started going nuts over the prospect of vaccinating their kids. Now, you would think, number one, kids are vaccinated for a whole host of different things before they can even be allowed in public schools. But you would think they would want to protect the health of their kids. But no, actually not. They don't. It seems to be very tribal and very lizard brain kind of thing that people say, well, I don't know what's in it. Well, you do know what's in it.
Yeah, you can Google it, and the ingredients are online, you know, for the vaccines, and you can check them out.
At this point, this is something else that really hasn't been covered adequately by really anybody. The rollout of the vaccine has been incredibly safe. We have now had close to 9 billion, that's B as in boy, billion, COVID-19 vaccine doses administered in the world. And the side effects have been vanishingly small compared to almost any other vaccine that's ever existed. The safety record is unparalleled, and it really is remarkable, how much was accomplished in a relatively short period of time. And we're seeing that all over again with Omicron, literally, there are new scientific papers coming out studying this thing every day. We're learning more as we go because this is a new virus.
Yeah.
The accomplishments of the scientific community have been absolutely without parallel in the history of the human race. Full stop. And that really hasn't gotten the kind of attention that it deserves.
I agree.
And there's also been in people's push for questioning the vaccines or the vaccine. They use the singular when, in fact, these vaccines are being produced by numerous companies in numerous countries.
And they don't all rely on exactly the same technology. So
exactly.
They impact your immune system differently.
So I think there is – certainly a legitimacy towards individuals to question a specific vaccine, you know, that they might have issues with. For instance, let's say the J&J with people with heart issues, you know. Mm-hmm. But you have a wealth of other options available to you. And yeah. And I've been, you know, following conspiracy theory for as long as I've been doing radio. And so there are options. I think people do have good concerns for questioning big pharma, but you know, you can go to a long menu list of other places. Let's say the vaccine produced in Cuba, you know, it's like that probably is relatively safe from the big pharma industries, you know, so I don't know. It just seems like.
But the problem is that all of them have Bill Gates' microchip in them.
No.
The conspiracy theories are not all rational.
Yeah, and some of them are just based on outright lies. And I think that those outright lies, we tend to say, oh, you know, only an idiot would believe that. But, you know, you'd be surprised at the number of people who engage in idiot behavior. You know, I'm not saying they are idiots. It's just sometimes they're not rational when it comes to making certain decisions.
Some of them are very bright in many aspects mm-hmm. of their lives. And then they go down the rabbit hole.
And that kind of lying, should have some criminal consequences to it when it involves a life or death situation like this.
And so. When it involves people who have incredibly influential platforms, Tucker Carlson and Koff.
Yes.
You know. Those kind of folks have a lot of blood on their hands.
So, Job, I know on your list you had booster inequity as one of the items. Did you want to touch?
Yeah, on that? The fact that you know, there's been a lot of coverage of the very skewed rollout between rich countries and poor countries of vaccine access. There are still some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, that have not gotten any original vaccine shots. The COVAX program from the United Nations, which is meant to try and address that and, you know, recruit donations from wealthy countries and from big pharma to try and get them to poorer countries, has not gotten nearly as many doses as they would have liked. And yet here we are now with Omicron and the world facing a really potent and really contagious variant of COVID-19. And, you know, scientists are saying that, well, you know, two shots doesn't really do it, but if you have had a booster shot, then you will have some protection. Well, booster shots are a thing in wealthy countries that have access to the vaccine. Basically Europe and the United States and East Asia. What you're saying then is that for Omicron, there are vast sections of the world, South America, Central America, the Caribbean, Africa, some parts of Asia, etc., where there is no protection against Omicron, because two shots won't do it. And the number of people and we saw this in South Africa, where only about 35% of the country has had two shots, but almost none of the country has had three shots. So, you know, and this kind of calculus is just going to keep getting worse, and the inequity between rich and poor countries is going to keep getting worse, and that really hasn't been covered yet at all. The Western media has not picked up on it.
Yeah. I would agree. But one thing that the Western media also hasn't picked up on or reminded us of as regularly as they should have is that the U.S. has had more COVID-19 cases and deaths than any other nation in the world. Over 500,000 deaths in 2021 alone, and a total of over 52.5 million positive cases overall. And that's a conservative number.
Yeah, that's almost certainly an undercount.
Yeah.
And we don't hear that either. We hear the official numbers, which are horrific enough. But the fact that even in this country with a really extensive public health reporting system, you know, a lot of it's undercounted. A lot of deaths are undercounted.
Now with a lot of at-home tests for COVID-19, people are testing and staying home and not reporting their illness to anyone. So there could be a lot of positive cases of particularly the Omicron variant that are relatively mild that are just not being reported. Now, COVID-19 currently is the third leading cause of death in the United States behind heart disease, which kills about 659,000 people per year, and cancer, which kills about 600,000 people per year. Both of those are killing more people in 2021 because of the collapse of our healthcare system under the weight of COVID-19 cases. People are not getting the cancer screenings that they need, and other people are not getting the treatment for their heart disease that we've come to expect from the U.S. healthcare system. Now, by October 2021, COVID-19 had become the number one cause of death for people ages 45 to 54, the number one killer. Okay. By comparison, in a bad flu year, about 50,000 people may die of influenza. Okay. We've had 10 times that number, not double, not triple, not quadruple, but 10 times that number die of COVID-19 this year, this past year alone.
Remember at the very beginning of the pandemic where Trump would dismiss it as, oh, it's no worse than the flu.
Just a bad flu.
Apparently it is.
It is. It's 10 times worse. Okay. So that's something that the media has not reminded us of nearly as much as they should have. Number four on my list is also related to COVID-19. It's the COVID long-haul syndrome, is a real thing, and it's a real burden. An estimated 50 million Americans who have been infected with COVID-19 have experienced lingering symptoms that last weeks or sometimes months after they've tested positive for the virus, even if they only had a mild case of COVID-19 initially. Researchers have estimated that over 1.3 million Americans may remain so sick with lingering symptoms that they won't be able to continue holding down a job for indefinitely. Okay. And that number is a very conservative estimate. As many as 2/3 of the people who get COVID-19, or about 35 million Americans, will develop long-term symptoms that will be a challenge for the U.S. public healthcare system in the years to come. And we don't have, because this is a brave new world for us, we don't have any idea how long those symptoms are going to last or if those people will be needing healthcare assistance for the rest of their lives. Possibly the latter, because as we do know, COVID-19, especially the Delta variant now, can cause major scarring in your lungs. Once you've scarred lung tissue, it does not go back to normal. Okay. So those folks will be needing some kind of healthcare assistance for the rest of their lives. So that is something that I've seen a couple of stories in the media, but I've not seen any discussion at policy level, any discussion at the public health level, or any discussion of in-depth research to try to help people who have COVID long-haul syndrome. Although I have seen stories that question whether it's a real thing, you know. I have to say that is really irritating.
Yeah, it is. And particularly for, you know, anybody who has over the years suffered from Agent Orange because they were in the military, or suffered from fibromyalgia or some of the other
chronic fatigue, which chronic is often fatigue. Brought on by viral infections.
Yeah. And, you know, first we find out the symptoms and then later we find out what the mechanism is. Mm-hmm. But always there is this intermediary stage where even doctors will question whether patients are just being emotional or whether they have some psychological problem. It's not psychological. It's very real. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And the same thing has happened with long haul, and it's very, very unfortunate.
Yeah.
And no coverage in corporate media about looking at our particular healthcare structure here in the U.S. and maybe making some tweaks.
Maybe making some major changes to make it more equitable and more efficient in serving the largest number of people.
It's a strange thing how the mortality rates for COVID-19 differ, and there's a fairly good correlation with countries that have universal health care and countries that don't. Mm-hmm. Now, you can also make the case that countries with universal health care tend to be the more modernized countries, but the United States is the big exception to that, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a higher mortality rate. Go figure.
Yeah.
But I'm glad somebody's making money. So I have, speaking of making money, another story on my list is the increasing extremism of the Republican far right, and not just the Republican far right, but the far right period, where you've got explicit neo-Nazis that are recruiting from the anti-vaccine movement and the anti-mask mandate movement. You've got a lot of discussion on far-right social media platforms like, Telegram, et cetera, we need a civil war. We need to resort to violence. We'll talk in a minute about January 6th, last year, but that was seen as a dry run by a lot of people. I'm a little concerned about, coming up this coming Thursday will be the first anniversary of that event. Whether that's going to be an excuse or whether, they'll find another excuse later in the year for terrorist attacks. I think that the risk of that is very real. And the dehumanization of political opponents, particularly on the far right, the authoritarianism, is very, very real and very concerning. And to the extent that you're getting, people in the Republican Party now and in positions of power who are basically making common cause with this kind of stuff, it's very, very concerning. I don't think the threat to the democracy is over by any stretch. And that's something that really didn't get a lot of attention this past year.
And then next on my list is in September, the conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court refused to block a Texas law that bans abortion as early as 6 weeks before many women even know they're pregnant, essentially a ban on abortion in Texas. That law also allows private citizens to sue anyone who helps a woman get an abortion, basically setting up a paid vigilante system to rat out and punish women who attempt to exercise their reproductive rights. That's a piece of the law that has already been found unconstitutional by a judge in the state of Texas under the Texas state constitution. But that hasn't stopped the law from shutting down all women's health clinics in Texas, which have all stopped performing abortions as the law winds its way through the courts. Women in Texas are now traveling outside of the state to get abortions, some even going south of the border into Mexico to get their reproductive health care. So I think that
the Mexican Supreme Court legalized abortion this year.
Major. Yeah, that was a major story. And I don't think the mainstream media really analyzed it well enough to give people the information that here, we now have a conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, and Roe v. Wade really is at risk here because this conservative Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, allowed this Texas law to go on the books, a law that's already been found partially unconstitutional in the state of Texas, and which you would think the U.S. Supreme Court would at least have said, look, it's already been found partially unconstitutional. We need to just, stop it in its tracks. But nope.
Yeah. And, I was watching a cable news show on a network that shall remain nameless yesterday, and they were talking about how the big impact of that is that it might help the Democrats in the 2022 midterms.
Yeah.
And it's like, what about the women who are directly affected?
I know.
Not every woman can pick up
stakes and go to Mexico to get an abortion.
That is the worst case, of horse race reporting I've seen in a while. And God knows I see a lot of it.
The next one on my list is, and this one kind of relates to COVID-19. There was an outbreak of Ebola in Guinea this year. And it changed what we know about how long viruses can linger inside their human hosts after people have recovered from the virus itself. Full genome sequencing of that Ebola virus outbreak this year from recently infected people found that the virus is nearly identical to the virus that caused the 2014 to 2016 Ebola pandemic in West Africa. That was absolutely astonishing to researchers. This means that that virus had been hiding out inside human hosts in parts of their body that are protected from attack by the human immune system, so-called privilege zones, like the inside of your eyeball, the central nervous system, and for men, inside their testes. And that virus had been lingering there inside of a human host for at least 5 years. The previous record for a virus to have been found to be hiding out inside a human host was thought to be 500 days at the maximum, about a year and a half. 5 years makes it seem like traces of a virus could survive indefinitely inside a human host. And this means that for something like COVID-19, something like the Delta variant in particular, which has been particularly lethal, that it's super important for people, even if they've been infected, to get vaccinated to spark their immune system to try to eliminate as many traces of the virus that could be hanging out inside their body as possible.
Yeah.
So that was astonishing news. It was not covered hardly at all in the U.S. media. But here in the part of the world where we've had the most COVID-19 infections, it should have been covered widespread in the press and should have been used as an argument for vaccine mandate.
One of the other things on my list, I said I was going to mention more about January 6th. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is the sort of thing where people just know it. They don't, they can't point to any particular story because there haven't really been any stories specifically about this, that Republican Party leaders in the White House and in Congress helped to plan the January 6th riots last year. This is, the evidence for this at this point is overwhelming, and it's come out drip by drip. You know, the Select Committee in the House of Representatives is accumulating a lot of this. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest stories of 2022 is when they start holding public hearings and releasing their final report, probably in about a month and a half. So look forward to that. But in the meantime, we know that there is a remarkable amount of culpability within the Republican Party for the attempt to overthrow the results of the 2020 election. And, is that important? Yes, it's important, because if those people are not held accountable, they're just going to do it again in 2024. And, you know, we may not have a free and fair election after that. It's very much a concern. It's a concern in the midterms this coming year. We're seeing the voter suppression in a lot of Republican-controlled states. And, the Democrats had better pass voting rights legislation or we're not going to have a free and fair election again in the future. Period, end of story. And that should have been a major story all the way through 2021, and it was not.
Yeah, I agree. Now my list starts getting into some discussion of climate change. Right. Every year.
Oh, yeah.
Climate change makes the list. Right. Well, the collapse of the Champlain Towers condo building in Surfside, Florida, demonstrated the real human toll of rising sea levels. So a lot of times people will say, oh, you know, sea level rise, that's something that will be slow and that we can adapt to. Right. Well, constant flooding of the condo building's basement contributed to erosion of the concrete support pillars, and flooding is now common in Surfside and nearby Miami, where the sea level has risen about a foot in the past 25 years. Once you start adding in other things like hurricanes, like this year we had Hurricane Ida in September, raging wildfires throughout the West and Midwest, which have continued, including in Colorado just this month, well past the wildfire season, and a record
and that just
tornado
wildfire season. That you know where it, the fires were fanned and pushed into heavily populated areas by 115 mile an hour winds.
Yeah.
Those winds were from a historically strong cold front, the same one that you know we're on the backside of now. You know, upwind of Colorado, and you know, created downpours for a week in California and epic snows in the Sierra Nevada. You know, these are extreme weather.
That record tornado season that we had this year, long past when tornado season should have been over. You begin to see a pattern of overlapping disasters, which have an enormous human toll from human-caused climate change. And the media is not covering that very well.
And they're especially not covering it between disasters. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, they're starting to make connections, and I just say starting because
when those disasters happen,
when the disasters happen, you know, when something like Hurricane Ida hits, I mean, rapid intensification of hurricanes is not something that was ever discussed before about 3 years ago. And that's very clearly a product of warmer seawater temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico, which in turn is a product of climate change. These storms are much more powerful than they used to be, and they develop much more quickly than they used to. So, you know, you're starting to get that kind of discussion when disasters happen. But between the disasters, I mean, this should be something people are shouting from the rooftops every day that, oh, by the way, we're also facing an existential crisis to the entire biosphere. And not just human life, but, you know, all kinds of life.
When weather becomes unpredictable like that, not only does it directly impact people when a storm is happening, but it will impact things like the growing season and the ability of our farmlands to produce a steady food supply. And it will affect fresh water supplies around the world in places, particularly in places that are now experiencing record droughts. Is an existential crisis for the human race. You know,
yeah,
there are too many of us on this planet now for us to take risks with our food and water supply. But that is exactly what we're doing every day that we continue business as usual with our carbon emissions.
Yeah.
So also on my list is, you know, on our overhyped list, we had the coverage of dissension in the ranks in the Democratic Party in the House. But this year, Congress passed a historic $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill to fix the nation's transportation infrastructure, to provide broadband to underserved communities, to upgrade drinking water systems for 10 million Americans, and to provide $100 billion to address climate change, particularly to upgrade the nation's energy grid to connect clean power sources. It's just really a proportion of what was proposed, but let's not minimize the real achievement of this bill. Remember, Donald Trump had promised an infrastructure bill in order to get elected back in 2015 and 16. And even with a Republican majority, he wasn't able to get an infrastructure bill passed. And even then, his idea of an infrastructure bill was building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. A big deal.
And he never really seriously proposed an infrastructure bill. Now, he promised a proposal was forthcoming, you know, at any number of different points.
But it never happened. Yeah.
But it never happened. Not once.
And here.
And to the point where Infrastructure Week became a running joke among, you know, DC media.
Exactly. And here, the largely Democratic controlled Congress managed to pass an infrastructure bill fairly quickly. Now, the human infrastructure
bill. No Republican support whatsoever. No Republicans voted for it. Now, plenty of Republicans went back to their district and started bragging about how all the infrastructure was going to be built because of this bill, but they all voted against it.
Yeah. So let's not forget that real achievement. Now, it would have been nice to have a second human infrastructure bill. That one's still held up in Congress, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But let's not minimize the fact that we did get this big, historic $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill passed this year.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead and talk about the other bill too.
Okay. So,
infrastructure.
So, my next, well, I'll just go down, continue down my list. My next topic on the list was research published in July in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that Americans' medical debt is approximately twice as high as anyone had predicted. It totals about $140 billion and is the single biggest source of debt in collections in the United States. And this study doesn't include medical debt caused by COVID-19, since this data was all collected prior to 2020. Okay. About 18% of Americans hold medical debt that has gone to collections. Okay, that's over 59 million people. But this is not a complete picture of overall medical debt in the United States because it only measures debt that has been sold to collections agencies. Many hospitals choose to pursue debt on their own, and they file lawsuits directly against their patients for non-payment, which can lead to high legal fees and wage garnishment. And that number, that those numbers, those cases are not included in this total. Many, in addition, some patients choose to pay their medical bills with credit cards that rack up fees and interest charges and contribute to bankruptcy. So those cases are not also included in this total. Nevertheless, medical debt is still $140 billion and affects over 59 million people in the United States. That was an astounding report. I saw it in, I think, one place in the media this year. And, in a pandemic, it should have been front page, big headline news.
Gosh, you would think that socialized medicine might, like, you know, be part of that discussion.
You would think, wouldn't you, that maybe we should be doing something to take the people having to pay for life or death type treatment out of the private market and doing something to make medical care more widely available to the extent that it doesn't force you into bankruptcy and force you out of your home to live on the street, you know, in a lot of these cases.
Yeah, it's a leading contributor to homelessness.
It is a major contributor to homelessness. And yet in all the discussions of homelessness, we see talk about drug abuse and, you know, people who are mentally ill. We don't see the people who are on disability or the people who have encountered bankruptcy because of their medical debt. But that is a major contributor to homelessness, and it really must be addressed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jav, you asked me to talk about the human infrastructure bill, and I will now because the next item on my list is this year brought proof that anti-poverty programs work. So COVID-19 anti-poverty programs lifted 20 million families in the U.S. out of poverty, at least temporarily, cutting the poverty rate by 45%. So pretty much almost cutting poverty in half through three main programs. And those three programs were stimulus checks, an increase in food stamps, and expanded unemployment benefits. And these programs helped Americans of all races and all age groups in all 50 states. Okay. Now, when those programs expired this year, the Biden administration expanded the child tax credit and issued monthly payments of up to $300 per child to families starting in the second half of this year. Yet an extension of this program is one of the main reasons why the Republicans and conservative Democrats like Joe Manchin in the Senate are not supporting the human infrastructure bill, which is currently held up there in the Senate and has already been passed by the House. Those politicians need to wake up and see the proof. These small aid programs carry an outsized benefit. For low-income and unemployed Americans hit hard by COVID-19. And the human infrastructure bill contains many small programs like that, needs to pass. We need to have this kind of help in order to, you know, give people the small amounts that will stabilize their finances and help them up out of poverty. in the United States, that is mostly working Americans that we're talking about. But there are enough people who have become unemployed by COVID-19 that they also need that longer term assistance. In addition, the human infrastructure bill also includes a lot of money that will be devoted to address climate change. Major portion of the bill is related to money that should help with reversing carbon emissions to a large extent in the United States. And I think that's also a big reason why the Republicans are trying their best to hold it up.
Yeah, and it creates a lot of jobs, too.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Republicans don't seem to be very much
into that. Yeah, don't seem to be for jobs. In particular, I really... think that the Democrats need to put more pressure on Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema in the Senate to vote for the human infrastructure bill and to stop, particularly Joe Manchin, the conservative Democrat from West Virginia, from holding up the bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I had seen one on jobs list.
Yeah, I did want to get to this one. Last year, of course, the racial justice demonstrations were a huge story. Those demonstrations came out of initially the George Floyd murder, but then there were a whole string of different, questionable law enforcement murders that were, captured on videotape. And made the rounds of social media and outraged people. You had just as many of such killings this year as the last. The sad and very underreported story in 2021 is that, for all the different reforms that were enacted at the state or the local level in a lot of different places, including Washington State, you still had lethal use of force killings by on-duty law enforcement officers at about the same rate in 2021 as you did in 2020. And there was no shortage of ones that were captured on videotape and made the rounds for the world to see. I think between the pandemic – and
I think there's a gap between when laws are passed and when police departments actually change their policies to conform with those laws, or when the disciplinary process in local police departments gets updated in order to actually punish cops who don't conform to the law.
Well, I think it really requires a culture change.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've seen in Seattle with SPD and the reform process here, that culture can be very, very difficult to root out.
It can be very resistant to change.
Yeah, and very resentful of change, in fact. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know what it will take for the literally thousands of law enforcement departments around the country to have that kind of culture change. It's gonna be a generational kind of effort. And at the same time, the defund the police movement, which was making some headway in 2020, really had a lot of blowback in 2021. You had police unions, for example. I mean, there was a very bad shooting down in Los Angeles this past week, and the police union is out celebrating the fact that the officer involved killed a couple people. This kind of really reactionary representation in public media of law enforcement is it's retrograde. It doesn't help anybody, and it certainly doesn't help prevent these kind of tragedies. And with literally thousands of different law enforcement departments around the country, all it takes is somebody with a cell phone camera for something to blow up. And I expect something will in 2022, because it hasn't gotten better And at some point, people are going to react to that.
Yeah. And I had one last item on my list. Mm-hmm. In August, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a new report on the status of climate change. The Earth warmed about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, or 1.1 degrees Celsius has warmed from the pre-industrial era. If we act now to cut carbon emissions immediately, we could limit the global temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. But if we do nothing, if we continue business as usual, that will make the mean global temperature rise 2 degrees, then 3 degrees, then 4 degrees, with increasingly dangerous and fatal effects with each degree of temperature rise. There will be more severe weather in the future, regardless of what we do now, but we can still affect how severe future storms, droughts, wildfires, floods, heat waves, ocean die-offs, and pandemics will be if we act now. Now, the report was based on 14,000 different studies in the science of climate change. It's the most comprehensive IPCC report to date, and it was the most sobering, and it got very little coverage in the U.S. press.
Yeah,
it really was and should have been the wake-up call to say, hey, yeah, things are moving faster than we've ever predicted. If, for example, you go back to 2012, 2014, when scientists were looking at global warming, they were thinking this was going to happen over a 100-year period. It's been a little under a decade from then, and we're already seeing effects. Weather effects that they had predicted we wouldn't see for at least 50 years. So we need to take this report seriously, and we need to start doing stuff now and holding up money in Congress to be spent on climate change initiatives is absolutely stupid. And people need to be outraged and need to put the pressure on their legislators to do something and do something now.
And unfortunately, media standards in the United States prevent us from seeing exactly what the conclusion of this report is, which is basically if we don't do anything, we are effed. Can't spell that out, but you can use your imagination.
Yeah. So, Happy New Year.
Yeah. It can only get better, right?
Right.
It's been a rough couple of years, and we want to thank everybody for hanging in through the relentless bad news. We really appreciate our listeners. Happy New Year to everybody.
Yes.